You've tuned to The Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Yes, good morning and welcome. Today on the show, we welcome the Catholic editor and author Carl Olson, when he will be discussing all things news and media evangelization. Carl is our guest in the next segment. We pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet at the top of the hour, and you are invited to join us. Send me your prayer request by texting 251-928-2111. Lines are open right now. In the last segment, we look to the heavens when we welcome back astronomer Dr. Michelle Wooten, who will be telling us at this time of year where to look in the Alabama skies. Stick around until the final segment to find out more. So, with all this good stuff, I guess we'd better get this show on the road. Now, I don't know about you, but the word friendship seems to be the thing at the moment in the news. You've probably seen the news headlines about the Russian leader Putin meeting the Chinese leader Xi Jinping, and how they describe themselves as the greatest of friends. In fact, best friends. They describe themselves as best friends. Which got me thinking, really, about what is a friend. And, you know, yesterday we were talking about that woman who missed all her Zoom friends. Do you remember? And how the normal socialization that goes on post-pandemic didn't quite live up to some of the excitement that she had experienced while on Zoom during the pandemic, during lockdowns. But there were two other stories that really kind of caught my attention this morning. The first is a really sad one, but a very unusual one, or maybe it's not that unusual. And it involves a woman at a New Jersey high school. You may have heard of this. It's really unusual. The woman in question was aged 29 years old, but she enrolled in a New Jersey high school. Now, even I know that 29 is far too old to be enrolling in any high school. I mean, it's a little bit old to be enrolling at university, never mind high school. But this woman, who's originally from South Korea and came to the United States many years ago, she used fake documents to enroll. And while there, she very happily attended classes and befriended many of the children there. Now, I don't think there's any suggestion that this woman did anything improper at the school. It's slightly more complex than that, because when asked, she's now in court, she's facing charges of, false documentation and all sorts of things to do with schools. And she's due to appear, I think, finally in court in May. But anyway, it hit the headlines just in the last 24 hours. But the reason, the rationale she gave for wanting to go back to school was that she could have some friends. I know, isn't it tragic? 29-year-old. And it seems that when she came to the United States, she went to a high school and she had an idyllic time at her high school. And in a way, she wanted to go back to high school because she wanted to relive those happy days with many companions, many friends, and I suppose a sense of purpose and probably a very regimented day. which every school has. So that's what she wanted. So she did, she went to the extreme of re-enrolling in a school. But it really is pathetic, isn't it? 29, enrolling in a school. I mean, there's other ways you can get friends without having to go to such an extreme measure. But it got me thinking about friends, because there's been a whole battery of articles this side of the Atlantic about long-term friendships. And I think it's in response to the pandemic, how friendships deepen over the years and how they become more meaningful. And there's a kind of, there's a little bit of self-congratulatory aspect to many of these articles and the people featured in them. So they've had friends since kindergarten or school, and they're now friends in their 80s or their 70s, and they couldn't live without their friends and all that sort of thing. I mean, that's all great. That's all great. But there's a very interesting article, essay, written many, many centuries ago about the nature of friendship. And I think that the man who wrote it, Marcus Tullius Cicero, what he said about friendship has stood the test of time. Now, just to give you a little bit of background, this gentleman was writing round about 44 BC, so 44 years before the birth of our Lord. And Cicero by then was in his 60s, which by Roman standards was old, very old. And he was exiled to living in a farm outside Rome because he had got involved in various political shenanigans to do with Julius Caesar at the time and ended up on the losing side, I guess. So he turned to writing, really, to ease the pain of exile and also the recent loss of his beloved daughter. And in a period of months, he produced some very readable and very influential essays, which have definitely stood the test of time. And Cicero was part atheist, part philosopher. Now, he wasn't a Christian. He wasn't a believer in anything. He was a Roman. But that's his insights are still very interesting. And interestingly enough, have been built on by people like St. Augustine in our Christian era. And also Dante and others also referred to them. So he has a great influence on our thinking around friendship. And in his essay, which is entitled On Friendship, he sort of sets out what it is to be a friend. And I'm wondering if it's something that you have ever thought about. Now, do you remember we had somebody on a few weeks ago, I forget who, they were talking about some aspect of life, and I asked them about friendships. And they said that so many of our friendships are determined by geography, not by disposition. So the people you befriended at school were because you lived in whatever area you lived in and you went to school in that area and their parents lived in that area and sent their kids to the school and that's how you met. Or the kids on the same street, people in the same church, whatever it was. That's how your friendship circle kind of grew. And of course, the most obvious one is that you're born into a family. And you've got brothers and sisters and cousins and aunts and uncles, and your friendship sort of is crafted by that. But leaving family aside, because there's an old joke about you can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family. And it's true. You know, your family are there for life, for good or ill, and they are gifts from God in all sorts of ways, sometimes very hidden ways. But Cicero talks about what it is to be a friend. Now, the first thing he does very wisely is to differentiate that there are many different kinds of friendship. So the sort of friendship that the Russian leader and the Chinese leader have, which is, let's be honest, is for the cameras, for political purposes, international politicking. That's why they're such best friends, because they're sending a message, right, to the rest of the world, particularly the United States, to say, hey, we're together on this. You're not. So the different kinds of friends. Sometimes your friends will be business associates and you enter into a business together and you're friends because of the business and you want the business to succeed and you work with each other, collaborating on a project to get the business to succeed. Sometimes when the business is dissolved or things start to fall out over business matters, that's when the friendship ends effectively. Often, not always, but often. Then there's low-key friendships, which are really acquaintances, which are your neighbors, maybe. People you say hello to on the street, people you know in your church, but you don't really know them very well. You would always say hello to them and greet them. You maybe see them every week. People you see in your locality, whatever it is. Remember, you're out dog walking and you see somebody on a regular basis, you say hi and you have a little bit of polite discussion about the dogs and you walk on. That's a kind of an acquaintance. And these are quite common, these kind of acquaintances, but they're not exactly friendships, right? And I think what Cicero does is make a very clear distinction between these common and quite useful acquaintanceships with those which are friends, true friends. And he says that friends are really on a much deeper level and therefore are much more infrequent in our lives. And that's interesting because the general accepted wisdom is that you should have lots of friends, right? There's an article again today about a woman talking about TikTok and all the friends she had and all the rest of it. Well, as we talked about the other day, having thousands of friends on Facebook probably doesn't add up to very much. And it what's and they appear to be at a very, very superficial level. So Cicero's talking about a deeper level of friendships. And he says these special friendships are necessarily rare because they require so much time and investment by ourselves and the other parties. But, and here's the thing, he says that these friends can deeply change our lives, just as we can change theirs. And I'll give you a little quote from Cicero. He says, "With the exception of wisdom, I'm inclined to believe that the immortal gods, as he calls them, have given nothing better to humanity than friendship." But he's talking about a very specific type of friendship. He's talking about that person who you really find to be on the same wavelength as you, and you're able to develop a relationship with them. But then he makes some other observations which are equally interesting, and maybe in light of the Russian and Chinese handshakes, Cicero would say that only good people can be true friends. Only good people can be true friends. Why? Because people of poor moral character can have friends, but they tend to have friends for utility purposes, right? I will do this for you, you give me this. This is the friendship of the thieves and the scoundrels and the tyrants, right? Who can use each other for some purpose. And they can use good people, bad people, it doesn't really matter. That's the nature of people who are not true friends, right? They're using somebody else. And this is one of the other characteristics then that Cicero points out about friendship, that friendship is not a one-way street. It should make us a better person. Our friends should make us better human beings. Think about that. If your friends are asking you to do things immoral or to behave in ways that are beneath your dignity as a child of God, they're probably not your friends, right? What Cicero says is that a true friend will challenge you to become better because he appreciates the potential inside you. And he makes the very telling point that even when a friend is absent, he is still present. And maybe a friend is a sort of an accompaniment to our conscience. They're pushing us on. They're telling us you could be better than this. You ever heard that said to you? Sometimes your behavior or your speech about somebody and somebody stops you in your tracks by saying, "Kevin, you're better than that." It does stop you in your tracks. And it is true. You can be better than that. You are better than that. Now, Cicero then takes the thorny task or takes the thorny subject of old friends, new friends. Now, he's of the opinion that anybody can make new friends at any point in life and that older people in particular should be open to friendships, especially with younger people, as he says that this can enrich both the young and the old. And I think that's something that's sadly missing in today's culture, that idea that older generations can speak to younger generations, but also the younger generations can speak to us. We may not understand what they say some of the time or the lingua franca they're using, but that sort of openness to friendship, that friendship is a gift from God, and we should be open to it. But yes, we should also value those friends that we've known for quite a long time. But he's very keen that we shouldn't limit ourselves to the companions of youth, whose friendship may be based on interests we no longer share. Ever had that happen? Maybe you were great friends with somebody at school or university, and then as the years go on, you suddenly realize you have very little in common with this person other than what transpired 20 or 30 years ago. And all you do is reminisce and nostalgicize, there's such a word, the past. You live in this vat of nostalgia about what went on before. That's not really friendship anymore, he would suggest. Because what Cicero also says is friends are honest with each other. Friends will always tell you what you need to hear, not what you want them to say. Now, we know there are plenty of people in the world who will flatter us for their own purposes. We've all had the experience of that. But only a real friend, or perhaps a real enemy, will risk your anger by telling you the truth. And if they're a really good friend and they have your best interests at heart, that truth may be painful, but it may be just what you want to hear. And then that brings us to the point that Cicero makes, that friendships are essentially rewards in themselves. There is no point to a friendship other than friendship, or there shouldn't be. Now, there may be practical advantages to friendship, such as advice, companionship, support in difficult times. We get that. Maybe even business advantage sometimes. But at its heart, true friendship is not a business relationship. It doesn't seek repayment and it doesn't keep score. I'll give you another quote from the great man. Friendship is not to be sought for its wages, but because its revenue consists entirely in the love which it implies. Think about that. Think about that with your friends today. When you're going through your friends, think, is this an end in itself, or is there some ulterior motive here? Which leads me to the final point about Cicero and his detailed examination of friendship. And he says that we should choose our friends with great care. We should be very deliberate about forming friendships. If for no other reason than that they can be very messy and painful to end if we find out the so-called friend was not really a friend at all. So he urges us to take our time and move slowly and discover what lies deep in a person's heart before we make the investment of self that true friendship requires. Now, that's a pagan view of friendship, but I think you'll probably agree with me that it's pretty detailed. And it's pretty interesting how he comes to that, to those conclusions. He is, of course, very, very sensible about friendships, and in light of the recent news articles, he would say that friendships, yes, they can improve over time, and they can be even more delightful as time moves on, but also friendships can change, and that means that sometimes they can go in different directions. But I was also conscious of what C.S. Lewis, a Christian, many, many centuries later, said about friendship. He wrote a book called The Four Loves back in the early, late 50s, early 60s. And in it, he dissects the different types of loves, and one of them is the love, which is friendship. And in that book, he talks about the way in which we think in friendship. We have chosen who are our friends. But from a Christian perspective, he comes at it from a different angle and says that really what he describes as a secret master of ceremonies has been at work. Yes, the good Lord. And he goes on to quote and say, "Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you." And C.S. Lewis suggests that that is who our friends are as well, if sometimes in heavy disguise, that the Lord has sent them our way to help us, but he has also sent them our way so we can help them. And that is quite an interesting spin on Cicero's view, that the Christian view of friendship is one that it's not utilitarian, but it's a gift from God. It's not just a gift, as Cicero would have thought, a gift from God. And therefore, it has a purpose. And the purpose, as we know, is not simply, as Cicero would said, to make us better people, to hold us to account. The Christian friend's purpose is really to help each other to get to heaven. That's why we're here, to get to heaven, but also to bring as many people as we can with us to that wonderful destination. Remember what St. Thomas More said, we go to hell on our own, but we always go to heaven with other people. And that will include some of our friends and some of our acquaintances and everything in between. Now, when we come back, we will be meeting Carl Olsen, who is the editor of the Catholic World Report and also an author and a journalist and a keen observer of all things Catholic in the world. And looking forward to meeting him. Stay with me here on Archangel. When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old past said, or you got a friend in me. Yeah, you. Welcome back to Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Now, my next guest is probably well known to many of you. He is Carl Olsen, who is the editor of the Catholic World Report and Ignatius Insight. But Carl is also an author of many books, including Did Jesus Really Rise from the Dead? Will Catholics Be Left Behind? And the co-author of The Da Vinci Hoax, as well as writing many other study guides for the Word on Fire project. His most recent books on Lent and Advent, Praying the Our Father in Lent and Prepare the Way of the Lord, are published by Catholic Truth Society, I presume here in London. You may also come across Carl, his writing in various newspapers, periodicals, and magazines. He writes for Our Sunday Visitor, The Catholic Answer, The Imaginative Conservative, The Catholic Herald, the National Catholic Register, Chronicles, and the list goes on and on and on. And he joins me down the line this morning. Carl, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Hi, Kevin. Great to talk to you in person.
Yes, I better let them in on the secret. Carl and I have known each other for many years, but we've never actually talked. Carl and I have communicated often via email. Carl was when I was writing for Catholic World Report. I'd have lots and lots of correspondence with Carl. And this is the first time we've spoken, so it's very good to hear your voice.
Yes, my running joke is I tell people I know so many wonderful people in the Catholic world, and I've met none of them in person.
Well, that's partly because, correct me if I'm wrong, Carl, you live out in the wilds of Oregon.
Yes, for many years, my wife and I lived in her hometown of Eugene, Oregon, which, of course, is I think it's like the third or fourth largest city in Oregon. But a couple of years ago, we bought some property out in the country, and we're out a little ways, not too far. We do have electricity, but we have a few acres out here, and we really love it. I've been fortunate to work with a lot of wonderful people, but it's funny, there's some people like yourself that I've known, I've corresponded with for many years, but I've yet to meet them in person.
Well, it's very good to meet you now. But answer me this. And I mean, you are living proof, Carl, of the wonders of the technological age we live in. You and I may have misgivings about the way the 21st century and the high-tech elements of it are developing. But it means that I can be here in London speaking to you in the wilds of Oregon, and you can continue your editorial work instead of in an office. You've been working from home on a computer, I guess, for many, many years. But answer me this.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Catholic World Report, and I knew the Catholic World Report, I think before you became the editor, it was still a print magazine, and it was distributed over here in the UK. And I remember coming across it way back in the early 90s and being very impressed with it, very impressed with everything about it. And it helped me at the time in terms of my formation. But things have got decidedly darker over the years, and you have been editing the Catholic World Report for a good many years now. How do you keep going? How do you manage in this toxic swamp that is the news feed every single day? How do you manage to stay sane?
Yeah, it's actually a great question, Kevin, because I was recently telling a friend that I think when we look back, I think that the years 2010 to 2020 roughly might go down as some of the most transformative, mostly in bad ways, in recent history. And yet maybe that won't be the case, because who knows what people will say about 2020 to 2030. There's so many things politically, socially, within the church. I think for myself, first of all, is the fact that we're in a wonderful parish. We attend a Byzantine parish. We have since 1999. Wonderful people, wonderful pastor, being rooted in wonderful liturgy and just having that as kind of an anchor is very important. I have an absolutely wonderful wife of 28 years who has supported me, great friends. I think it's important to not get consumed by the bad news, but it can be very difficult. And I think it's important to see these things through hopefully the lens of prayer, of contemplation. I have a men's reading group that I've been part of for almost 20 years here. Having these kind of friendships, having that kind of stability is really imperative. I've watched people on social media over the years, and Twitter is my preferred form of evil social media. and I've literally watched people fall apart. I mean, on the screen, watching them disintegrate, some of them Catholic, some of them maybe not Catholic, like just kind of lose their mind, lose their way, become angry, lose all sense of perspective. I have people who keep me accountable. I mean, I have a really wonderful boss. I mean, I kind of work for Father Joseph Fessio, the incredible founder of Ignatius Press. You know, and honestly, this is not a joke, Kevin. I sometimes will think, okay, if I post this on social media, or if I say this in an interview and Father Fessio reads or hears it, what will he say? You know, my pastor keeps me accountable. He reads a lot of the things that I write. I talk to him on a regular basis. You know, it's important to have that accountability. I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm just saying that it's good to have that and to be grounded because, again, as I say, I've watched people, unfortunately, sadly, kind of fall apart, disintegrate. And it's not good. We have to be rooted in reality. Here's what I say. Ultimately, we have to be rooted in the person of Jesus Christ and his church and the sacraments. These are vital for any era, obviously for every Catholic, but certainly for us now, that's imperative.
Amen. You're listening to the voice of Carl Olson, who's the editor of Catholic World Report, Ignatius Inside, and an author, and many, many other things besides. I think you're absolutely right, Carl, that it is about being grounded, but you probably underestimate, because you've been doing it for so long, how a good editor, and I include you in that, and some of the people I've worked with, good editors, they help writers from self-destructing in their writing, if you know what I mean. Going too far in one direction or another. You must come across that where you've had something come across your desk and somebody's obviously not in a good mood or they're sounding off about something and you think, this is not going to work for them or for us.
Well, I laugh because I actually came up with a saying many years ago, because it's funny. I've been an editor now for many years, and actually it goes back to when I was editor of Envoy magazine with Patrick Madrid back in, over 20 years ago. I did that for a couple of years, and that was a really wonderful experience because I discovered that, you know, first of all, I kind of consider myself a writer first, but really in my work now, it's primarily as an editor. I obviously still write. But, you know, day to day, I do more editing than writing. And my saying is a writer, and I was thinking in terms kind of apologetics, but even broader than that. A writer writes to anger his enemies, but an editor edits to anger his friends. And there's some truth to that. I mean, it's obviously a little bit of hyperbole, but you sometimes do have to say to somebody who sends something in, sometimes even a regular contributor, and say, no, we can't do this, or I think this can be improved, or we need to cut this. And, you know, sometimes I've been fortunate. There's only a few occasions where people push back or say, I don't agree, or even every once in a while somebody say, well, I'm going somewhere else. But, I have to look at what I think is best for Catholic World Report. I really do like to be a writer's editor in the sense of I don't want to go in and rework pieces. Usually when I see a piece, I'll know within a few paragraphs if it's something that I'm going to seriously consider or not, you know, if it's unsolicited or whatever. I have a pretty clear idea. But that comes from just years of doing it. And of course, as you mentioned, you know, the fact that Catholic World Report, you know, was around for, oh, I think it was roughly 25 years or so in print form. The funny thing is, when I was offered the job in late 2011, I was told, hey, would you like to be editor of Catholic World Report? And oh, by the way, we're not printing it anymore. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting pitch. but the point was is that the print costs and the postage costs were becoming too much. But the idea was to go completely online. And I think the wonderful thing about CatholicWorldReport.com is that it's very flexible. I mean, it's 24/7, and you don't have a monthly approach. I mean, obviously, in today's world, if a story breaks and then you come out with something about it 4 weeks later, it still might be a good piece, but it's not going to have the same kind of, you know, oomph, the same kind of punch. I mean, sometimes you have to have things that are posted right away. Now, I do like to have pieces that are more analytical, that take a longer view, that aren't just immediate reaction, but you do have to have a lot, of course, a lot of immediate reaction at times. So, and the site continues to grow every year since I've taken over. We've gotten more and more readers, and it's completely free. So, it's been really wonderful.
Yeah, I've seen it grow, and I've seen its importance grow as well. And initially, I was a little bit, like most people who subscribe to it, a little bit put out that we didn't have a paper edition. But in some ways, I understood just the logic that you've set out there. But from an editorial point of view, Carl, the pressure on you is multiplied by 100 at least, because suddenly it's a daily 24/7 reaction to whatever's happening. And I suppose that's what I was asking, really. How do you cope with that? Because for a writer, you can take time out, right? A writer can say, next week, I'm just going on, I'm doing whatever, right? I'm not going to listen to the news. I'm not going to look at Twitter. But for an editor, you are on call 24/7.
Yeah, there's something to that. Now, one of the keys to our work is that we have from the beginning, and even I think prior to me taking over, we were partnered with Catholic News Agency and EWTN. And so a lot of our news briefs, a lot of those immediate notes that come from around the world come via the wire, you know, as you would say back in the day. So that is really important. I can't, you know, underestimate or understate how important that is. And then, you know, we have a really wonderful cast of contributors who, in many cases, I have so many people who send me unsolicited pieces that are really wonderful. I mean, out of the blue, I wake up and I'll have three or four pieces sitting in there. People say, you know, what about this? And so it's a challenge, but it's a really good challenge to have. And that I constantly have material to work with. Obviously, we can't cover everything, and obviously there's just so much happening in the world and the church, you have to make choices. I think you just get into a rhythm, it suits my personality. I don't know that, I mean, I have friends, we talk about this, I'm like, man, I could not do what you do. I mean, when it's 5 o'clock, I'm off work, I'm done,
right?
And I said, I get that. I've done those jobs when I was in my 20s. There's really positives to those jobs. But I just really am really fortunate. I really like this. I really like it. I enjoy it. I so far have stayed sane. So I think we'll keep going.
Well, it must be a sign of a vocation, Carl, and a divine one, because you sound completely balanced and happy and working on that cycle. I'm afraid I would agree maybe with some of your friends. It would drive me over the cliff, I think, having to be 24/7 dealing with the problems of the church. Now, Carl, I know it's very early for you out there, but can you stay for another segment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You bet.
Great. And we'll talk maybe a little bit more about your life as author and also a little bit about your backstory, because I know you're a convert to Catholicism as well, which not a lot of people know. I'm in conversation with Carl Olson. He's the editor of Catholic World Report and an author and many other things besides. If you have any questions for Carl, you can text me on 251-928-2111, or you can call and speak to Carl on 888-928-0881. Stay with me here on Archangel Radio. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency. Back after these words. back to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. And I'm in discussion this morning with Carl Olson, who is the editor of the Catholic World Report, Ignatius Press author, and many other things besides. Carl, while we were on break, something flashed across my mind, and I'm wondering if I dreamt this about you or if it's actually true. And this may not be the forum in which to discuss this, but let me put it to you anyway. Did I ever come across a Carl Olson who wrote extensively and celebratory about prog rock, or did I imagine that?
Yes, I have an illustrious background in writing about progressive rock and jazz. I was actually, it's funny, your bumper music there, Alan Parsons, I just recently found a really great copy of one of their early albums on vinyl for just a couple bucks. I was thrilled. I think it was iRobot. Yeah, I've been a huge prog rock fan since I was in high school.
And Carl, just for anybody out there who's not the same age as us, explain to them what prog rock is.
Yeah, so the term progressive rock has nothing to do with politics. We've got to emphasize that. The simplest explanation is that it's a movement that began in the late 60s into the 70s that married kind of classical music with rock music, and there was a very wide range of how this was done. Some of the early bands were bands like Yes and Genesis and King Crimson and so forth, and there's been kind of about three different ways of progressive rock, much of it coming out of England, as you know, and of course Scandinavia, America. Groups like Kansas were very famous in the 70s in America. And so it's just something I thought that music was always much more interesting even when I was in high school than just your standard top 40 rock music. And this comes from somebody who I we don't talk about shameful secrets. I, at the age of 19, attended a Def Leppard concert. Although in fairness to myself, I didn't plan to go. I was invited to go and actually turned out to be a really great concert, I have to say. But my real love musically is probably jazz along with a lot of classical. I listen to a lot of jazz music. I have probably about 5,000 or 6,000 jazz albums. I've lost count. And I think it's just to make up for the fact that I absolutely have no musical ability whatsoever. My lovely sister, younger sister, actually incredibly musically talented. And she's actually put out a number of albums and so forth. She's a pianist, a songwriter, a singer. I got none of that. My side was more the literary and artistic painting. But I do love music very much.
Well, it's funny you should mention jazz greats, because yesterday on our Storytime segment in the final part of the show, I told the story of Mary Lou Williams, who I'm sure is familiar to you, the great Catholic convert, also great legend and a wonderful woman, and how she really wanted to bring Christ into the jazz club. You know, I mean, it was quite a moving, really, to think of what her witness was and also her story, which I'm sure you know well.
Yes.
But yes, so the prog rock, I mean, the trouble is that prog rock has a slightly fun side to it, but a slightly ridiculous side in most people's consciousness. It's slightly over the top, as we'd say, in some of its. But I agree with you. I have exactly the same issue, not necessarily about prog rock, but about music in general, in that I have no interest in playing music and I have no real talent for music. But I have an amazing appreciation of music, you know, and I think that's my gift. That's my gift. So there are people to make music and there are people to appreciate music. And I'm definitely in that school. But you're also an artist. I know that. And I've seen some of your covers, for example, for the St. Austin Review magazine. And they're very interesting. They're very modern, modernist, cubist. You're a man of many, many parts. But let's focus on one part that may be of interest to people, which is that you weren't always a Catholic. How come?
Well, I was raised in a small town in Western Montana, and my parents my mom came from a nominally Lutheran background. My dad came from a nothing background in terms of religion. Mm-hmm. And they had born-again experiences a couple of years before I was born. I was born in 1969. And so I was raised at first in a small Church of God kind of community, and then later, when I was about 5 years old, my father co-founded a little Bible chapel in which I was essentially raised. And in fact, my parents are still involved in that little Bible chapel. By little, I mean they have like 100, I think 120 people or something each Sunday. And it was what historically we would call fundamentalist. And we were it was very anti-Catholic. Now, it wasn't something that we heard a lot about. Like, we didn't have sermons railing against Catholics, but rather we just knew that Catholics weren't really Christian. But we also knew that Lutherans were pretty suspect and Methodists were pretty wishy-washy and the Pentecostals were heavily emotional. And it boiled down to, you know, we were pretty much it. But there were many wonderful things, too, about my upbringing. And since it was very, I mean, I was memorizing scripture at the age of 3 or 4. There was a lot of great moral teaching. I mean, fundamentalist backgrounds, upbringings can vary a lot. Mine was actually quite good and quite sane. But theologically, there were a lot of issues there. And so after a couple of years of Bible college, at an evangelical Bible college, I really came out with a lot of questions. And throughout my 20s, I met my wife, who began dating, and then around the time that we got married, actually in 1994, I was starting to read early church fathers. I eventually got a copy of the New Catechism that came out around then, and started reading Aquinas and Augustine and Newman and Chesterton. These were all huge influences. And for about 2 years, basically, my wife and I were just doing a lot of studying of history. Looking at scripture in a new way, reading a lot of great Catholic, and sometimes, you know, I was a huge T.S. Eliot fan from the time I was seventh grade, which is probably kind of unusual for somebody growing up in nowhere Montana. Read a lot of like Charles Dickens and stuff like that. So there was kind of an Anglophile aspect a little bit. I really got into C.S. Lewis and Dorothy Sayers and so forth. But we entered the Catholic Church in 1997, and that was, it was a pretty big deal. I mean, our families were a little bit confounded by it. We had one family member who said, "I don't understand why you'd join a church that tells you, you know, what to think." And I told my wife later I should have responded, "Well, at least I'm joining a church that, you know, actually does think." That would have been a little bit harsh, but it was kind of tense. It's been wonderful. I mean, we've never, ever regretted it. It was, to me, it's just a sign of God's grace and really the communion of saints. I mean, looking back, I really see that aspect, that reality at work in our lives.
Yeah. You're also living proof, Carl, that it's always dangerous what you read, for good or ill, right?
That's right. That's right. Well, it's funny. My father, who's now 80, and is a really a man of great integrity, and a really a good man. He got frustrated with me back in those days and said, "You know, if you'd read books about Buddhism or Hinduism, you would have become a Buddhist or a Hindu." And I said, "I have read books on Buddhism, Hinduism, and Mormonism, and we looked at Eastern Orthodoxy. We looked at." I didn't mean like I was thinking about becoming a Buddhist. I wanted just to know what Buddhists actually believe. I wanted to know what the Eastern Orthodox actually believe and so forth. And so I'm not sitting here saying I'm an expert in those areas, but I had some wonderful teachers over the years who really impressed on me the fact that you can't be afraid of the truth. You know, now you want to be cautious. You don't want to be just... Obviously, there's limits. You don't want to dabble with Satanism or whatever. But it's good to know what people believe, the reasons that they give for their belief. And so I seriously looked at some of these things and continue to do that. And certainly my work in apologetics have done that. As Catholics, we should never be afraid of any question. It isn't to say that we'll immediately have the answer, but the answers are there. And so I think that's one of the wonderful things about being a Catholic. You don't have to be afraid of any questions, even if you don't immediately have the answer right there. They do exist.
You're listening to the voice of Carl Olson, editor of Catholic World Report and much else besides. In your day-to-day work, Carl, are you very conscious that what you're publishing will have an impact, not just on information giving, but spiritually perhaps, on some of the people who are reading some of the information that's put out there?
Yeah, it's a great question, Kevin, because one thing that I tried to do at Catholic World Report, and it reflects you know, my educational background is actually in theology. My master's degree is in theology. I kind of laugh that I'm, you know, that I'm described as a journalist. I mean, I've done journalism, but it was not never really my background per se. And so what I like to do at Catholic World Report is really have a number of pieces that are, we could call them catechetical, sometimes spiritual. We have pieces, we have regular pieces on the saints. We have regular pieces on theological things that are not always just about ongoing controversies. Obviously, there's a lot of those, but but also just give people encouragement, edification, help them understand the faith better. I don't want to be I don't want Catholic World Report to just be about news, as important as that is, or just putting out certain positions, but to present people to give them a sense of the vast array of the ways that the Catholic Church approaches so many things, literature, art, politics, culture, all these things. People see it's a complete worldview. It's a complete way of living and thinking. That's really important to me. And so we have pieces where we interview, you know, people like, you know, the poet Dana Gioia, or, you know, visual artists or musicians, and we review films and so forth. It's very important to me that we have kind of that breadth of material for folks.
And I think that's literally down to you, Carl, and I can speak with some experience of this. I mean, you give me free rein, really, to write about things which other editors would have said, well, what's this got to do with the Catholic Church? But, you know, my only defense was that of Chesterton when he was asked why he didn't write more about our Lord. He said, everything I write is about our Lord, which you will understand, but some people didn't quite get that. But there is quite a big responsibility, really, on the editor. I mean, I've had a question just come in, actually. I've got some questions for you here, but I'm enjoying the conversation too much. I'm afraid I'm hogging it at the moment. One of the questions is, what is the hardest story Carl has covered, or the best?
Well, I will say in general, there's two things that are really tough because they're so controversial. One is just Pope Francis in general. He's difficult to cover. And by cover, I don't mean just say, okay, Pope Francis said this, et cetera, but really trying to analyze and to very reasonably, charitably take a look at many things that have happened over the course of 10 years now, this pontificate, the synods, the controversies, because there are things there that are controversial, that are difficult, that are perplexing. And so that's very tough. And then certainly stories that deal with sexual abuse, clerical abuse, those things can be very rough emotionally, just in terms of you have to be, of course, very clear. You can't just throw stuff out there. We've had stories come in, be sent to me, where people make what I would consider accusations without sourcing, without substance. And maybe these accusations are true, but without the actual material, without the actual sourcing, you can't go with that. There has to be, I mean, these are really delicate, huge matters. If you're going to be making accusations about a priest or a bishop or whatever, there really has to be substance there, and you have to be very careful. And then, of course, just the emotional aspect, the spiritual aspect of that, it's just, it can be very, that can be one of the more demanding aspects of the job, because it's just so horrific when you read about actual things that have happened, of abuse, of what people have endured. It's really horrible. So those two things, I think, have been perhaps the most difficult.
Yeah, and I think we're really grateful to you and to everybody who's involved in shaping that, because it could become something so awful that we just turn off, or just polemical. But you don't. The Catholic World Report, I always think, is that via media. It seems to be able to just give you, it doesn't pull its punches, but it also doesn't sort of grandstand opinion just for the sake of it. A slightly more, maybe more charming question, which was, where can I find out more about Carl's art?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. Yeah, so I do have a half-formed personal website, carleolson.net, and I'm still working on I want to put up a lot of links to my various articles and stuff that are online, but it does have a fairly fully formed section for my artwork, design, fine art, etc. So carleolson.net, and I'm actually going to be adding some more things to that as I've been going through my files and I found some reproductions of pieces I forgot that I had. A lot of this artwork is older, but I actually continue to do design work. I think you mentioned I've done some cover designs for Ignatius mm-hmm. Press. They let me, moonlight on occasion. And so I've done probably 8-10 Ignatius Press book covers, which is really a lot of fun. It's a nice change of pace. It's really nice too, because they already have some incredibly talented designers and artists who do work for them. So,
absolutely. Well, is there a website for the prog rock or and the jazz specifically?
Well, yes, that's a great question. Brad Berzer and I years ago founded a site called progarchy.com. We're no longer involved with that for various reasons. And I've not been able to write as much about music recently. Occasionally, Brad has a website called Spirit of Cecilia.com, where he posts things about music, and I occasionally do. But if somebody does a search for just Carl Olson and like jazz, or Carl Olson prog rock, you'll find, or look at progarchy.com and look for my name, you'll find some archive things where I bloviate, shall we say, on music, everything from, yeah.
Yep. I'll be doing that probably after this program finishes. Carl, unfortunately, our interview has finished. This is incredible. The time has just absolutely flown by, and I must say it's been an absolute pleasure. I knew it would be meeting you. People can find out more at catholicworldreport.com.
Yep, absolutely.
That's great. So for now, from the court of the Crimson King, Carl, we bid him farewell until we meet again. Carl, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Kevin.
When we come back, we will be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you're very much invited to join us. Stay with me here on Archangel Radio.